Ever feel like you want to make smart investment decisions, but maybe not just blindly follow what Wall Street tells you?
Absolutely. It's that desire for control, for understanding what you're actually putting your money into.
Exactly. So today we're doing a deep dive into a book that really aims to help with that. Fire Your Stock Analyst Analyzing Stocks on Your Own. It came out back in 2006.
Yeah, and what's interesting is how much of the core thinking, understanding the business, figuring out value is still so relevant today, despite all the market shifts.
Right. It feels like a really practical guide to like getting under the hood of a company.
And deciding if it actually fits your own strategy.
So our mission here for you, the listener, is to pull out the really actionable stuff from this book. The goal is to help you get a better handle on stock analysis, no matter your starting point.
We want those aha moments, right? Where it clicks and feels less like some kind of secret Wall Street code.
Totally. And the author, he wasn't just theorizing, he had years of experience teaching, writing, investing his own money.
Yeah. Studied all the gurus, synthesized his own approach. And crucially, he actually talked to lots of successful investors, gathered their real-world takes.
Which is probably why it feels so grounded. Okay, so from all of that, the book lays out basically three key areas for us to explore.
Yep. First, finding potential investments. Where do you even start looking?
Second, how do you analyze those candidates once you've found them? The real nitty-gritty.
And third, deciding when it's time to sell, which can be just as hard as deciding when to buy.
Okay, let's jump into that first part then. Finding investment candidates. Where does the book say to begin? It feels like a huge universe of stocks out there.
It really pushes the idea of screening first. Think of it like using filters on a giant database, the entire stock market.
Okay, filtering to narrow it down.
Exactly, based on specific criteria that matter to you. It's just a way to make the task manageable,
Yeah.
avoid getting totally overwhelmed.
Makes sense. But what kind of criteria are we talking about? What filters should you even use?
Well, the book stresses starting with yourself. What are your investment goals? What's your comfort level with risk?
Ah, okay. Like, do I prefer big, stable companies, or am I okay with smaller, maybe riskier ones?
Precisely. Just answering that helps you slice off a big chunk of the market right away.
Yeah.
Are you looking for large caps, mid caps, small caps?
Got it. So company size is a big one. What else for initial screening?
Valuation ratios. They're like a quick temperature check on how the market views a company's prospects.
PE and PS ratios, right. Price to earnings and price to sales.
Those are the main ones mentioned.
Yeah.
Generally, high ratios suggest the market expects strong growth. That attracts growth investors.
And low ratios.
Often attract value investors. They're hunting for companies the market might be undervaluing.
So a high PE isn't automatically bad, it just signals a different investment style, more focused on future growth.
Exactly. And then there's the buzz surrounding a stock.
The hype, or
Yeah.
lack thereof.
Yeah. Negative buzz, bad news. That can really hammer a growth stock, maybe make it one to avoid.
But for value investors.
Here's where it gets interesting, like the book points out. Negative buzz might actually be a buy signal for a value investor.
Really? Like everyone else is running away, so you go take a look.
Kind of.
Huh.
If the negativity seems overblown compared to the company's actual fundamentals, it could be an undervalued opportunity. The book says don't just run from the crowd. Sometimes run towards the pessimism, cautiously.
That's counterintuitive, but makes a certain kind of sense. Looking for those unloved stocks.
Often, yeah. And many value investors take it a step further by setting target prices.
Specific buy and sell points.
It adds discipline. Helps you wait for the price you think is right, rather than getting swept up in emotion or market noise.
Okay, that sounds smart. Discipline is key. So we run a screen, get a list. What's next? We just buy them.
No, definitely not. The book is really clear. The screen just gives you research candidates, potential ideas.
Right. So more work needed.
Yes. Do some initial digging on those names. Maybe you find something you don't like right away. Then you can actually go back and tweak your screen parameters, refine the list further.
The book also mentions pre-made screens on financial websites. Are those useful?
They can be. Especially for beginners, it's a way to see what kinds of criteria people use. But the caution is, don't just blindly follow them.
You still need to understand why those stocks showed up.
Exactly. It's a starting point, not an answer machine.
Okay, so screening gives us a manageable list. Then the book talks about a quick pre-qualify stage. What's that involve?
It's like a quick sanity check. Before you spend hours digging deep, do a fast check using easily accessible info, like maybe a Reuters profile and snapshot.
What are you looking for in this quick check?
Basic stuff. What sector and industry is it in? Does that fit your interests? What's its market cap?
We talked about size, micro, small, mid, large cap. Why revisit that here?
It just confirms alignment. Large caps often mean more stability, maybe slower growth. Small caps, potentially faster growth, but more risk, less analyst coverage sometimes. Does this company's size fit your overall plan?
Okay. What else in the pre-qualify?
Trading volume. How many shares trade hands each day, on average?
Liquidity. Can you get in and out easily?
Exactly. The book suggests a rough rule of thumb. Maybe avoid stocks trading less than, say, 50,000 shares a day. Low volume means it might be hard to sell quickly without impacting the price.
Okay, that's practical advice. It also mentions float. What's the deal with float?
Float is the number of shares actually available for the public to trade, not shares held by insiders or governments.
Why does that matter?
A small float means fewer shares are available. So there's sudden buying interest, the price can shoot up fast. And vice versa, it can drop quickly too. More potential volatility.
Got it. So check sector, plan industry, size, volume, float. Anything else in this quick pass?
One last crucial step. Check the buzz again. But this time, look for immediate deal breakers.
Like major negative news.
Yeah. Have they just lost a huge contract?
Yeah.
Facing a massive lawsuit? Is their main product suddenly obsolete? Anything that screams major problem right now.
That makes total sense. Why waste time analyzing a company that's already clearly in deep trouble?
Precisely. It's about efficiency. Filter, then quick pre-qualify to weed out the obvious non-starters.
Okay, so we've screened, we've pre-qualified, now we have a list of companies that seem worth a deeper look. This is where the real analysis begins, right? The part that can feel intimidating.
It can, but the book breaks it down. The core idea it starts with is that a stock's price basically reflects the market's expectations for future earnings growth.
So analysis is largely about understanding and evaluating those expectations.
That's a huge part of it, yes. And where do expectations often come from? Analysts.
Right. But the book draws a line between buy-side and sell-side analysts. What's the key difference for us?
Buy-side analysts work for the institutions actually buying stocks, mutual funds, pension funds. Their research is internal, guiding their firm's decisions.
Okay. And sell-side?
They work for brokerage firms. Their research reports get sent out more widely, often to clients and the public. And here's the critical point the book makes. Potential conflicts of interest.
Conflicts? How so?
Well, many of these brokerage firms also have investment banking arms. They make big money helping companies go public, issue debt, do mergers.
I see where this is going.
Right. There can be pressure, subtle or not, for the sell-side analysts at that firm to maintain positive ratings on companies that are, or could become, lucrative investment banking clients.
Wow. So a strong buy might be influenced by hoping to get that company's next big deal.
It's a potential factor. The book even mentions analysts sometimes getting bonuses tied to helping win underwriting deals.
Okay, that definitely makes you look at analyst ratings differently. The book has that example, right? Andy and ADC.
Yeah, the analyst kept a buy rating on ADC even as the stock tanked and the business fundamentals were clearly getting worse. It illustrates that potential bias really starkly.
So the takeaway isn't that analyst reports are useless.
Not at all. They can be great for background info, understanding the industry, getting details about the company.
Right.
But the book warns you to be skeptical specifically about the buy-sell recommendations themselves.
Okay, so treat the recommendations with caution. How else can we gauge what analysts think? The book mentions a sentiment index.
Yeah, that's a way to sort of quantify the overall mood. It looks at the proportion of analysts with strong buy ratings versus holds or sells.
What does that tell you?
Well, extremely high positive sentiment, everyone loves it, could actually be a warning sign. Maybe expectations are too high, setting it up for disappointment.
And low sentiment, everyone hates it.
That could be interesting for a value investor, as we discussed. If the negativity seems overdone, maybe it's an opportunity. So the sentiment index gives you a broader feel beyond just one analyst's rating.
Okay. What about target prices from analysts? How should we use those?
Analysts often give a price they expect the stock to reach in, say, 12 months. For a value investor, this might be another data point when setting their own buy or sell targets.
But again, with a grain of salt.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's still just an estimate, potentially influenced by the same biases. The book contrasts this target price focus, typical of value investing, with GARP growth at a reasonable price, suggesting target prices are more central for value folks.
All right. The book then gets into some specific valuation checks. Like the PS to PE translation. What's that for?
It's mainly a check for value investors, comparing the price to sales ratio with the price to earnings ratio. Basically, are you paying a reasonable price for the company's sales relative to how much profit it actually generates from those sales?
Sort of a reality check on the valuation.
Exactly. If the PE implies a much higher valuation than the PS suggests is reasonable based on historical margins, it might be a flag.
Then there's a method for calculating your own target price range. How does that work?
It uses the company's own history. You look at its typical PE ratio range over, say, the last 10 years, find the usual high and low.
Okay, historical PE range.
Then you find a consensus forecast for its future earnings per share, its EPS.
Right, analyst estimates.
And you multiply that forecast EPS by both the historical high PE and the historical low PE. That gives you a potential target price range.
Using its past valuation norms to frame future possibilities, the Alpharma example in the book walks through this.
It anchors your expectations in the company's own track record, not just current market hype.
Makes sense. Okay, beyond valuation numbers, the book hammers home the need to understand the actual business.
Absolutely fundamental. What does a company do? What are its products? Who are its customers? How does it make money?
You can't value what you don't understand.
Pretty much, you need that context to judge future prospects or if the current price makes any sense. The book suggests resources like Reuters investor profiles to get that overview.
Then zooming out from the company, we need to look at its industry. What are the key things there?
Understanding the industry landscape is crucial. How fast is the industry itself growing? That's a big one.
Is that data easy to find? Industry sales growth forecasts.
Not always directly, the book admits. It suggests a workaround. Find industry earnings growth forecasts, which might be more common, and then maybe discount them by roughly 30% as a rough estimate for sales growth.
Okay, a rule of thumb. And different investors look for different growth rates, right?
Yeah, growth investors might want to see industries growing at, say, 15-25% annually, while value investors might be okay with slower, steadier industries if the price is right.
What about competition within the industry?
Super important. Is it dominated by a few giants, like an oligopoly, or is it really fragmented with tons of players?
Why does that matter for profits?
Fewer competitors usually means more pricing power and potentially higher profit margins. Lots of competitors often leads to price wars and lower margins for everyone.
Got it. The book introduces a business plan scorecard. Sounds formal. What is it?
It's just a structured way to think about the strength of the company's actual business model. A checklist, almost.
What's on the checklist?
Things like, how strong is its brand? Does it have barriers to entry things that stop competitors, like patents or maybe locked-up distribution channels? What's the useful life of its products? How easily can it get supplies? Is it diversified across products or markets?
And it also asks about how the company grows, organic versus acquisitions.
Yeah, that's a key one. Is growth coming from selling more of its own stuff, organic, or mostly from buying other companies?
Why is buying companies potentially risky?
Well, you can overpay. Integrating the new company can be messy and fail to deliver the expected benefits, the synergies. And relying too much on deals gets harder as you get bigger.
Okay, that scorecard seems like a good way to systematically assess the business quality. Next up, management quality. How do we judge the people running the show?
It's tricky from the outside, obviously, but the book suggests looking at executive resumes of the experience in this industry. How long have they been there? High turnover at the top can be a bad sign. Reuters officers and directors' reports can help here.
What else beyond resumes?
Look at their accounting practices. Does the company constantly use non-recurring or one-time charges to make their regular earnings look better? The book shows how to track this as a percentage of sales over time.
Looking for patterns of trying to pretty up the numbers.
Exactly. And also, just general earnings growth stability. Does management consistently deliver? Or are results all over the place? That reflects on their quality too.
Okay, management quality checked. Then comes a big one, financial strength analysis. Avoiding blow-ups, basically.
That's the goal. Avoid companies heading for bankruptcy. The book points out how even big names like Enron had buy ratings shortly before collapsing, so you need your own checks.
What's a key metric here? Debt.
Debt is huge. The total liabilities to equity ratio is a core one. High ratio means lots of debt relative to the company's net worth, higher risk.
Are there other warning signs?
Yeah, the book mentions busting cash burners. Companies reporting profits but actually losing cash. Comparing operating cash flow to working capital needs can flag this.
And it mentions Piotrowski's work, financial health tests.
Joseph Piotrowski developed a scoring system using basic financial data to identify financially healthy value stocks. The book offers a modified version, especially for companies that already have a fair bit of debt, say a TLE ratio over 0.5.
What does the score look at?
It's a checklist based on recent trends in profitability. Is net income positive?
Mm-hmm.
Leverage, is debt growing slower than assets? Liquidity, can it pay its bills? Current ratio improving? And operating efficiency, or margins improving? Is asset turnover better? You get points for meeting criteria.
So it's a quantitative way to assess financial health. Could this have flagged Enron?
The book suggests that this kind of analysis, focusing on cash flow and balance sheet trends, might have raised red flags earlier than just looking at reported earnings.
A very useful tool. Okay, next section, profitability and growth analysis. What's the focus here?
Simple premise. Over the long run, stock prices tend to follow earnings. So you need to analyze the trends in a company's sales and profits.
What specifically do we look at?
Compare recent sales growth to historical growth. Growth investors might want to see at least 15% year-over-year growth recently. Value investors might ignore recent dips, but want to see decent long-term growth, maybe over 5%.
And profit margins?
Crucial. Operating margins, net profit margins, are they stable? Improving? Even small declines can be significant warning signs.
What about return on equity, ROE?
It's important. Shows how effectively the company uses shareholder money. But the book adds a caution. ROE can be artificially boosted by taking on lots of debt.
So how do you check for that?
Compare the ROE trend to the growth in the company's book value per share. If ROE is high, but book value isn't growing much, debt might be the reason. Return on assets, ROA, is mentioned as another useful metric.
And cash flow comes in here again, too.
Definitely. Free cash flow, the cash left over from operations after reinvesting in the business. Capital spending is key. You want to see consistently positive operating cash flow.
The book mentions EBITDA, too.
Yeah, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It's another way to look at operating profitability before certain non-cash charges and financing costs. Harder to find sometimes, but MSN Money apparently lists it.
Okay, analyzing profitability and growth trends. Now the part everyone worries about, detecting red flags, spotting trouble before it hits hard.
Yeah, this is critical. The book highlights several areas. First, sales growth trends again, but looking closer.
How so?
Look at quarterly year-over-year growth. A significant slowdown, even if growth is still positive, can be a major red flag. If growth drops from, say, 40% to 20%, that's a big deceleration the market might react badly to. Zoll Medical is the example used.
Applies to forecasts, too.
Yes. If analyst forecasts for future sales growth suddenly drop, that's concerning.
What about the balance sheet, receivables and inventories?
Big potential red flags here. Accounts receivable money owed by customers should ideally grow roughly in line with sales.
What if receivables grow faster than sales?
Trouble. Could mean they're having trouble collecting cash, or maybe stuffing the channel, offering loose credit terms just to make sales numbers look good. Watch the day sales outstanding, DSO. If it's rising, that's a warning.
And inventory.
Similar logic. Inventory should track sales. If inventory levels are piling up while sales growth is slowing.
Means they might have stuff they can't sell.
Exactly. Could lead to future price cuts, write-offs. Kmart and Walmart are mentioned in this context. Plus, there's the temptation for companies to inflate profits by overstating the value of their ending inventory.
Sneaky. Okay, another subtle one. Comparing operating cash flow to net income.
Right. Usually operating cash flow, OCF, should be higher than net income, because net income subtracts non-cash charges like depreciation.
So what's the red flag?
If a company consistently reports more net income than the actual cash it's generating from operations, OCF, that divergence needs explanation. Could signal aggressive accounting. Motorola is the example here.
Are there other, maybe less urgent flags?
The book mentions yellow flags. Things like big jumps in capital expenditures or weird shifts in income tax rates. Not immediate panic buttons, but things to investigate further.
Okay, lots of potential flags to watch. Finally, in analysis, examining ownership, who owns the stock matters.
It can give you clues. High institutional ownership, lots of shares held by mutual funds. Pension funds can be seen as a stamp of approval, especially for growth stocks.
What kind of levels?
The book suggests maybe aiming for over 40% and being cautious if it's below 30%, suggests the smart money has vetted it.
What about insiders owning stock, executives?
Some insider ownership is good, aligns interest. But too much, say over 55%, could be a concern. Maybe they control the company too tightly or could dump a lot of stock later.
And insider selling?
definitely a red flag if top execs like the CEO or CFO were selling a significant chunk of their personal holdings recently. They know the business better than anyone.
Okay, wow. That's a comprehensive analysis process. We've found candidates, analyzed them inside out. Now, the final piece. When do you sell?
Just as important as buying. The book stresses needing clear sell guidelines before you even buy. Don't make it up on the fly.
What triggers a sale for a value stock, according to the book?
Could be reaching your predetermined target price or fair value estimate, or if the company fundamentals deteriorate those red flags we talked about, like rising receivables or inventories, maybe worsening debt. Also, trouble at key competitors or significant insider selling.
And for growth stocks, they can drop fast.
Yeah, the book acknowledges that. The emphasis is often, the first loss is the best loss. Don't let a small decline turn into a disaster by hoping it'll come back. Have stop-loss rules, perhaps.
Makes sense. Keep emotions out. Does the book suggest monitoring things after you buy?
Absolutely. Pay attention after earnings reports. Read the new analyst reports. Did they pick up on something you missed? Listen to the company conference calls.
Why the conference calls?
You can sometimes get nuances, tone, and answers to analyst questions that aren't in the press release. And read those press releases carefully, too. They often come out before the official SEC filings. Early insights.
Good tips. Lastly, the book briefly touches on avoiding outright scams. Pump and dumps, fraud.
Yeah, the nasty side. It suggests a couple of quick hype checks for stocks that seem too good to be true, especially tiny companies.
Like what?
Make sure it has a reasonable minimum market cap, maybe $50 million, to filter out the really tiny, easily manipulated stuff. And check the price-to-book ratio, especially if there are no real sales or earnings. If PB is crazy high, like over 25, be very wary. The Miracle Tech example hits these points.
Right, basic sanity checks against pure hype.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so bringing this all together, the real value here from diving into fire your stock analyst seems to be about empowerment.
But exactly. It gives you, the listener, a framework, a set of tools and a process to actually do your own homework, to understand what you own and why.
Moving beyond just taking someone else's word for it, especially when that word might be, well, biased.
Precisely. We've covered finding candidates systematically through screening, analyzing them thoroughly, valuation, business management, financials, red flags, and then thinking strategically about selling.
All drawn from the practical advice in the book.
Yeah, it's a roadmap, really.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. Think about one company you're familiar with, maybe one whose products you use every day or one you hear about constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just try applying one or two of the ideas we discussed, maybe a quick check on its trading volume or its receivables trend versus sales, or just understanding its basic business model a bit deeper.
What might you uncover if you start looking beyond just the stock price?
It might surprise you what insights pop out when you take a more active role in understanding the fundamentals. Give it a try.